Welcome to Idea the Future, the podcast concerning evolution and intelligent design. I'm your host today, Ray Boland, and with me is Dr. Michael Egnor, a pediatric neurosurgeon at Stony Brook Medical School. And he's commented recently on Evolution News on a few blog posts from Jerry Coyne, who's a evolutionary biologist, now retired, I understand, at the University of Chicago. And he's been very involved in promoting atheism, actually, beyond being a promoter of evolution. And he wrote an article recently that was endorsing euthanasia for severely handicapped infants. So, Michael, are you ready to go with this?
I certainly am, Ray.
Let me just read one of his first quotes here that you put into the article where he gets things started here. Jerry Coyne says, the question of whether one should be able to euthanize newborns who have horrible conditions or deformities or are doomed to a life that cannot by any reasonable light afford happiness has sparked heated debate. Coyne goes on to say that philosopher Peter Singer has argued that euthanasia is the merciful action in such cases, and Coyne says he agrees with him. So if you are allowed, Coyne says, to abort a fetus that has a severe genetic defect, microcephaly, spina bifida, so on, then why aren't you able to euthanize that same fetus just after it's born? Coyne simply says, I see no substantive difference that would make the former act moral, the abortion, and the latter one immoral. How do you initially respond to that?
Well, I agree with Coyne in a limited way. I don't see much of a moral difference between killing a baby in the womb who's handicapped and killing a baby who's just been born who's handicapped. Where Coyne and I differ is I think both of those things are profoundly immoral. I think deliberately killing anyone, let alone a baby, let alone a handicapped baby, is a grotesquely immoral thing. And certainly no conscientious physician should ever be involved in such a thing.
Well, Coyne, he goes through great lengths, so I justify himself. He goes on to say, after all, Coyne says, newborn babies aren't aware of death, aren't nearly as sentient as an older child or adult, and have no rational faculties to make judgments. And he says, and if there's severe mental disability, well, they would never develop such faculty. So he's indicating here clearly that, well, that they're not even aware. So what's the big problem?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, when a person is not aware of what's being done to them, under ordinary standards of morality, you are obligated to give them more care and more respect, not less care and less respect. If a person is disabled, if a person is incapable of defending themselves or caring for themselves, morally, we have a greater responsibility to protect them. And it certainly doesn't mean that they can be killed if they're not aware that you're killing them. After all, toddlers aren't aware of death either. It doesn't mean that it's therefore okay to kill a toddler. A person who's in a coma isn't aware of death, and it doesn't mean it's okay to just kill a person who's in a coma. Your elderly grandmother with Alzheimer's may not be aware of death either, but it doesn't mean you should kill her. In fact, a person who's sleeping isn't at the moment that they're sleeping aware of death. It doesn't justify killing them. And in what moral universe is doing an evil act to a person who's unaware of the evil act making that evil act not evil anymore? For example, there are many profoundly handicapped people who would not be aware of sexual molestation or rape if it was done to them. But it certainly doesn't mean that it's okay to do it to them. So not being aware is reason to protect someone more, not less.
Well, Coyne tries to go on and justify his decision a little further. You quote him as saying, Jerry Coyne says, it makes little sense to keep alive a suffering child who's doomed to die or suffer life in a vegetative or horribly painful state. He says, after all, doctors and parents face no legal penalty for simply withdrawing care from such newborns, like turning off a respirator. But Singer, Coyne says, suggests that we should be allowed, with the parents' and doctors' consent, to painlessly end their life with an injection. Coyne simply says, I agree. What do you think?
Well, it has long been a principle of medical ethics that it is perfectly ethical to withdraw heroic care in a situation where the care is simply prolonging the process of dying and stands no reasonable chance of saving the person's life or of giving them a significantly better quality of life. I have many times, as a physician, ordered with the consent of the family and or the patient that heroic medications like antibiotics or medications to support blood pressure, or ordered that respirators be removed when the treatment was simply prolonging the patient's process of dying. That's perfectly ethical, and I think every reasonable person would agree that if you are in that condition, you'd rather not have really extreme, heroic things done simply to prolong your life. That's a very different thing than deliberately killing someone. Deliberately killing someone is a morally completely different matter than withdrawing heroic care.
Well, what I hear you saying essentially is that there is a point when the body actually simply starts to shut down. And I think you just referred to that as the process of dying. And I think what you're calling on then is to simply say that when that process starts, you can't reverse it. It's inexorable. And so withdrawing heroic care, as you say, is the right thing to do, but you're not killing them. The dying process has already started, correct?
Correct. If you withdraw heroic care and the patient passes away, on the death certificate, the cause of death is the underlying cancer or the underlying trauma, whatever it was that actually killed them. However, if you inject them with a barbiturate or a potassium, if you're being honest, the cause of death on the death certificate is lethal injection, not the underlying disease. So when you're withdrawing care, you're simply allowing a natural process to continue when the care itself really is not capable of ameliorating that patient's condition. On the other hand, if you're injecting the patient with a lethal substance, that is what's killing the patient, not the cancer. A person who has terminal cancer who's given a lethal injection by his doctor didn't die of cancer. He died of the lethal injection by his doctor. That's a very different thing.
Yeah, it is a very different thing. I agree with you totally. Well, you go on to refer now to Coyne's recounting some of the uproar that the philosopher Peter Singer has had to endure, endorsing this sort of thing. What he actually said was, Jerry Coyne says, for these views, Singer has been demonized by disability rights advocates who have called for his firing and disrupted his talks, all for just raising what Coyne calls a reasonable ethical question that should be considered and discussed. Now, you had a pretty clear response to that.
Yes, the people who are disrupting Peter Singer's talks are the people that Peter Singer proposes killing in the crib. Many of these folks in these disability organizations have very severe disabilities themselves, and they are the very people that Peter Singer and Jerry Coyne are suggesting should have been killed as babies. While I think that disrupting someone's talk is generally a bit rude, and I don't necessarily endorse that, if there is ever a time when one can understand why somebody would disrupt a talk, it's if the person giving the talk is an internationally respected philosopher who's saying that you should have been killed when you were a baby. I doubt that Singer or Coyne would have sat through a lecture quietly in which someone recommended killing atheists as babies.
Well, what he seems to appeal to next is that this sort of thing has already been legalized at the end of life. And quoting Jerry Coyne again, he says, after all, 50 years ago, the same kind of opprobrium would have been leveled at those calling for voluntary euthanasia, assisted suicide of terminally ill adults. But now that's legal in several places in the world. And he refers to Wikipedia here as saying that as of June 2016, human euthanasia is legal in the Netherlands, Belgium, Colombia, Luxembourg. Assisted suicide is legal in Switzerland, Germany, Japan, Canada, and the U.S. states of Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Vermont, Montana, Washington, D.C., and California. But what he's basically saying is that, well, we've already legalized in other places. Why not continue the onslaught?
Well, in modern times, the first legalization of euthanasia in the Western world was in Germany. The process began in the 1920s. With the publication of a book called, in English translation, Life Unworthy of Life. And it was a book by a couple physicians who recommended that people who had severe handicaps, their lives really were better ended, better for them and better for society. And they recommended it, although the title of the book was rather callous, they actually recommended it in large part to prevent the suffering of the people who were being killed. That idea gained traction in the German medical community, and when the Nazis came to power in the early 1930s, it was incorporated into a program called the T4 program. There was a confidential system by which people in Germany could call a number, a special number, and report a handicapped person who lived in their area who they felt perhaps was suffering or whose life was so miserable that euthanasia should be considered. This person was then taken involuntarily, if necessary, to a medical panel, and the medical panel would examine the patient, and they would vote on whether the patient would be euthanized or not. And if the patient was voted to be euthanized, they were taken to one of several centers in Germany. One of them was Hadamar, and they were euthanized. They were usually gassed. Occasionally, they were injected. And the T4 program ultimately was shut down at the insistence of a very heroic Catholic bishop in Germany who defied the Nazis and gave sermons saying this was a terrible thing. And even the Nazis abandoned it in the early 1940s because it was so distasteful. After World War II, 16 doctors were placed on trial in 1946 who were involved in the T4 program and in other programs, for example, programs at Auschwitz. And they were convicted of crimes against humanity, and 7 of them were hanged. So there is precedent for what Coyne is recommending, at least. And it was considered a crime against humanity when it was first done. And I think it still is a crime against humanity.
Well, I just recently checked Dr. Coyne's site, and he's not too thrilled with being labeled as a possible Nazi. But as you indicate, perspectives and various ideas about euthanasia have kind of gone back and forth over the last 100 years. But he goes on to say in his initial blog post, Coyne says, this change in views about euthanasia and assisted suicide are, he says, the result of a tide of increasing morality in our world. That just seems like a really strange thing to say.
Yes, certainly the deliberate killing of handicapped people is not increasing morality in any kind of world that I'd want to live in. And I think it's delusional to think that that's an increase in morality. It might be an increase in efficiency. It might be an increase in getting rid of people like Coyne feel are unworthy of life. But it certainly is no increase in morality.
Well, Coyne is fairly famous for being a cat person, and he loves his kittens and so forth, and he makes a comparison then to dogs and cats. Jerry Coyne says, after all, we euthanize our dogs and cats when to prolong their lives would be torture, so why not extend that to humans? Dogs and cats, like newborns, can't make such a decision, and so their caregivers take the responsibility. He says, I've done this myself, as have many of you, and firmly believe it's the right thing to do. He says, our pain at making such a decision is lessened knowing that dogs and cats, like newborns, don't know about death and thus don't fear it. So killing a newborn is not much different than killing your dog or cat.
The problem is that it sets a standard for human ethics. That is a standard that we wouldn't abide by in any other situation. Richard Weikert has this fascinating analogy. He said, well, we deal with homeless animals by rounding them up, taking them off the street, putting them in shelters and cages. We give people several weeks to adopt them, and if they're not adopted, we gas them. Should we do that with homeless people? And obviously we shouldn't. So the use of analogies to the way we treat animals for moral guidance in treating people is a deeply flawed way of reasoning.
Well, let's try to wrap this one up, and let's go to a final quotation that you use from Jerry Coyne, and where he actually has addressed the connection to Nazi-like eugenics, and get your final comment here. Jerry Coyne says, my view then aligns with Singer's, Peter Singer's, the philosopher. A child falling in any of the classes above should be considered as a subject for euthanasia, and it should be legal if the doctors and parents concur. As for what he calls the slippery slope argument that this will lead to Nazi eugenics, well, this hasn't come to pass in places where assisted suicide and euthanasia of adults is legal. Since newborns can't decide, it's up to the parents, with advice and maybe consent of the doctors. So he simply says, well, we haven't slipped into Nazi-like eugenics yet, so what's the problem?
Well, I would agree with him that this is not a slippery slope into Nazi-like eugenics. This is Nazi-like eugenics. we're already at the bottom of the slope, in a sense, that if you are legalizing the deliberate killing of handicapped people, let alone handicapped babies, mm-hmm. you're already in Nazi territory. That's what they did. And regarding the slippery slope argument, I find it ironic that COINS advocacy now is a perfect example of a slippery slope. That is that when physician-assisted suicide was first promulgated in Oregon and Washington and various states, the people who advocated physician-assisted suicide said, this is not a slippery slope. You know, we're not talking about euthanasia. We're not talking mm-hmm. about the doctors killing people. We're talking about the doctors writing a prescription and giving the person the autonomy to do what they want to do. We're not pushing euthanasia. Of course, that was made legal in several states, and now they're pushing euthanasia, COIN mm-hmm. included. So COIN is an example of the slippery slope, and it's a slope we never should have set foot on. One quick thing about COIN's arguments regarding suffering of infants, and this leads into my story about Dr. Marusco. He assumes that severely handicapped children suffer disproportionately. And I've been treating these kids for 30 years. I've treated tens of thousands of these kids. They don't suffer disproportionately. Most of these conditions are not the least bit painful. They sometimes have to go through surgery, but we provide them with anesthesia and we provide them with analgesics. And many of these children lead very good lives. And even though their families may suffer because their children are handicapped, and that's an emotionally very difficult thing for the family, the children themselves generally don't lead lives of pain or suffering. And in fact, their handicap sometimes makes them unaware, in a sense, of the difficulties they have, which lessens their suffering. So they don't suffer disproportionately, usually.
Well, you end up closing your blog post by giving the reader some perspective, and you talk about several cases of individuals you've worked with who've been treated for various diseases. But you end up talking about a particular young lady born with spina bifida who ends up a neurosurgeon similar to herself. Can you tell us a little bit about Karen?
Sure. When I was a medical student, I wanted to be a neurosurgeon, and I rotated on the neurosurgery service at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York. And the resident I was assigned to was a young woman named Corinne Marusco, and I was sort of her shadow. I'd follow her around, and she'd teach me. And Dr. Marusco was training to be a neurosurgeon. She had spina bifida herself, and she had had surgery as an infant with one of the doctors that she was actually training under. And she had a shunt, which is a tube in the brain to drain fluid internally, and she walked with leg braces, and she had a special platform that she would stand on to operate. And I had trouble keeping up with her. She was an incredibly good resident. She's brilliant, worked extraordinarily hard, and we became good friends. We've interacted over the years at conferences and so on. She's gone on to have an extraordinary career. She's right now a professor and chairman of neurological surgery at the University of Michigan, and she's one of the leading neurosurgeons in the world. She is one of the top clinicians, one of the top researchers. She's served on the American Board of Neurological Surgery. She's currently on the Residency Review Committee, which is a committee that approves training programs. So she's reached the pinnacle of our profession. And she's a person with spina bifida. She's a person who has all of the things that Jerry COIN believes that she should have been killed in infancy. So the reality is that people with these disabilities, not everybody is going to go on to be a brain surgeon.
Sure.
But the vast majority of these children can lead quite happy lives, and many of them lead rather good lives. I had a young woman who I've been taking care of since she was a little girl who has spina bifida, and she had a lot of issues. She went through a lot of surgery. She was very frightened of the surgery. It was always tough for her to go through this. And one day I was in the office and I saw her and she needed another operation. And she broke out in tears because it was really hard on her. And so when that kind of cleared up, we got talking. She mentioned to me that she was in college and she was making pretty good progress. And I asked her what she was studying. And she said, medical administration. And then she smiled and says, I'm going to be your boss someday. So she's not quite there yet, but she's making progress. So these people's lives are precious. These people's lives are valuable. I find it just profoundly disturbing that their lives would be denigrated in such a way that COIN is doing. It's an affront to these people, and it's a terrible thing what he's saying, and obviously it would be terrible if people did it. So these children should be protected and cared for and loved, And if they are in a situation where they are suffering, which is not common, but if they are suffering, and medical care at that point does not seem to be capable of alleviating their suffering, one can withdraw heroic treatments. That is ethical. But deliberately killing them is a moral abomination.
So we appreciate so much your perspective and your healing hands to so many, as you said, thousands of them over the years. And Dr. Egnor, we're so glad you joined us today. And this is ID the Future, and thank you so much for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.